Okay, we're beginning here, 9 lines down on the top of Kuf Nun Vav Amud Aleph. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Shmuel Bodkim. We check in instances of Likidushin. We're talking about halachic engagement, Begerushin, the giving of a get, Ulechalitza, for the Yavam to terminate his obligation to marry the Yavama, Ulemiunin, and the annulment of a rabbinic marriage, Vilim Korban Echse Aviv, Achi Ben Esrim, and to engage in the transactions with the familial property. That's only until the age of 20. So what's being said over here by Rav Nachman Amar Shmuel is that even though normally we rely on the chazakah, which is that when children reach the age of 12 for a woman, 13 for a man, that we assume that even though we haven't checked, that they are gedolim. We assume that they have reached the point where physically their maturation is keeping up with their age, and therefore we assume that they have shtei sarot, they have pubic hair, in order to make them gedolim. That chazoka, what we're seeing now from Rav Nachman and Rav Shmuel, is only true when we're dealing with dinei derabanan. But when it comes to dinei deoraita, we're not going to rely on that chazoka, but rather we're going to check to make sure that that is the case. Now, in checking to make sure that's the case, we're only going to do it the chumrah and not the kula, which means that, for instance, if we go and check an individual, a young man, who proposes kiddushin to a woman, and we're not sure, we're uncertain as to whether he is a gadol or not, and whether the kiddushin are effective. So then we're going to go check and see. If he has shtei se'arot, we're going to assume that he is a gadol, and the kiddushin are binding. On the other hand, if we find that he does not have shtei se'arot, that doesn't mean we're going to say that the kiddushin were invalid, and they had no meaning whatsoever. But rather, we're going to say now it's a safek, shema nashru se'arotav. Maybe the hairs fell away, maybe we couldn't find them when we did the bidikah. So it'll turn out that the bidikah will only work the chumrah, not the kula. And the Baal HaTosafot say that at the end of the Baal HaTosafot, the Girushin, they say that dochak namar, the bodkim, the kedushin, danim lo matzu se'arot. They didn't find any hairs there, lo tei mekudeshet, that they won't be mekudeshet at all. The lo chashin and shem nashru. And to say that maybe we don't worry about the fact that the hairs fell out, because then it'll turn out that Shmuel's memory here is not the halacha. And his point being that we do worry about these things, and so the bedikah can only make it the chumrah to establish the fact that they are gedolim, but it cannot establish the fact that they are not gedolim, and that will leave us in a state of safek. The Baal HaTosafot also note that the bedikah, achar she'hegiyah l'chlal shanim, this check is only if they reach the age where we would assume that they are gedolim, but aval mikame shanim, if it's prior to the age of 12 years and 1 day for a girl, 13 years in 1 day for a boy, then we won't check there at all because we assume that the sarot are shuma ba'alma. We don't assume that those are indications of becoming a gadol, but rather we assume that they are shuma ba'alma. So here is a check that is demanded over here in these four instances, which the Gemara will discuss the necessity for some of them, are because they are issues de oraita. And since they are issued de'oraita, therefore we won't rely on the chazakah and we'll actually do a check. Exception to that is miyun, which is a din derabanan. Over there, we will go the kula, meaning that we will force the check in the situation, but we will also take it the kula, which means that if we find that there are no hairs there, we will assume that she is a tana and she has the right to still annul her marriage, because that is a din derabanan. The last line that they have and why it's relevant to our Gemara over here is transacting in his father's possessions in the familial inheritance, that he has to wait until the age of 20. There is no bidika. It's simply that saying that the threshold is 20, not the threshold of 12 or 13, which is true for these other items. Now the Gemara asks the question, v'kem in the batkano, the kedushin, if we already checked to ensure that the kedushin were viable kedushin, the gerushin, lamali, then why do I need to check by gerushin? By definition, if you tell me that you have to check by Kiddushin, then they've already checked them at the point of Kiddushin, then Gerushin, which always has to succeed Kiddushin, it can't come before, then of course you've already done the Bidika and you have the information that you need. So why would you have to do a Bidika for Gerushin if there was a Bidika already done by Kiddushin? The Baal HaTosafot over here asks, why is this such a strong question? There are instances where we wouldn't have checked by Kiddushin. For instance, they got married, and there's no questions about the marriage. There was nobody who tried to have Kiddushin with her after that fact. So there was no reason for us to check to whether to see he was or wasn't a gadol at the time of the Kiddushin. They got married. And now it comes to Gerushin. At this point, we need to check because there was no check done at the point of Kiddushin. Or You could have just phrased the question in the following manner, which is Mimonafshach. If he was a gadol at the time of Kiddushin, then now he's a gadol at the time of Gerushin, it works. If he was a katan at the time of the Kiddushin, then he might be a katan now, but it won't matter, Mimonafshach, because then he only got married, technically, Midrabbanan. So you can also get divorced, Midrabbanan. So why at the time of Gerushin do you need to do any check? Because it will cover whatever Kiddushin was relevant. Because you can't be a Gadol at the time of Kiddushin and a Katan at the time of Gerushin. You were either a Katan at both, or you were a Gadol at both, or you were a Katan at Kiddushin and a Gadol at Gerushin. And Mimonafshach, there's no necessity to check at the time of Gerushin. So you either have to say that the case here is a case where they already did check at the time of Kiddushin because somebody subsequent to the first Kiddushin came and attempted Kiddushin. Or you have to say, and Okanami, the Gemara could have answered that it was a case where they didn't check by the case of Kiddushin, and therefore they have to now check by the case of Girushin. And even though you could have answered Mimonafshach, the Gemara has a better answer to this, and therefore it posed the question in this manner in order to teach us the following, which is, Lo Nitzricha Ela LeYibum. It's a case where there was no Kiddushin, the marriage was entered into through someone else's Kiddushin. His brother had married this woman, passed away without any children. And then he, as a brother, now came in to perform Yibum. That's none. We have a Mishnah in the Masechet Yevamot. Ben Tisha Shanim V'Yom Echad. A boy who's reached the age of 9 years in one day. Shebal Yivimto. If he has Biyah with his Yivama, Kana'a. Mido Raito. The Yibum has taken place. Ve'inu Ten Get Achigdal. But he can't give a get until he's already grown and come of age. So the Gemara comes up with a Hechitimsa, with a case where it's possible that the person would be involved in a marriage relationship whereby they entered into the marriage relationship when they were a katan, and they cannot exit from it until they are a gadol. And that's a case of yibum. Because when it comes to bi'ah, we have the Gemara tells us in other places, both has to do with onshim, as well as to do with kiddushin and yibum, that for a young girl from the age of 3 years in one day, and for a boy from 9 years in one day, their bi'ah is considered to be a biyah, and therefore for arayot and other items, they will be punished, not the katanim, but the other individuals involved in that. Or in cases of yibum, the yibum will be consummated with these individuals. So here, a young man who's 9 years and one day could consummate the marriage through yibum, but he still doesn't yet have the power to divorce midol right until he's 13 years and one day. So there's a case where there would be no check for the yibum, because it doesn't matter about the shtei sarot, it just matters about his age if he's 9 years in one day. And as far as get is concerned, when it gets to the point of Girushin, it will matter, and therefore they'll have to check by Girushin, even though there was no check by the Kiddushin. The Chalitza, why does he state here that you have to do a check by Chalitza? Lafuke mid Rabbi Yossi. This comes to exclude or contradict this position of Rabbi Yossi. Damar ish ketuv v'parsha, that the only requirement by Yibum that someone be of age, by the case of Chalitza, the only requirement that someone be of age is with regards to the man. Aval Isha, when it comes to the woman, Ben Gdola u Ben Ketana, whether she's of age or not, it doesn't matter, and Chalitza can be performed with her. As the Rashbam points out over here, that by Chalitza of the man, everybody agrees that he has to be of age, because they learned it out from Gerushin. And so that Limud teaches us that the man must be of age. The question is there a hekesh then between the woman and the man to say that the woman must also be of age? So we have a machloket about this, and Rabbi Yossi believes that she does not have to be of age. Kamash Malon, that Amar Rav Nachum Mashmul coming to teach us over here that Chalitza requires a bedika, and the bedika is the bedika of the woman over here, telling us that even the woman also must be of age when it comes to the performance of Chalitza, not just the man. The Machshinan Isha Liish, the local Rabbi Yossi. Because we have this hekesh between a woman and a man, unlike what Rabbi Yossi says, where their dinim are separate, then the man has to be of age, but the woman does not have to be of age. Ulu mi'unin, you also have to do a check for mi'un, which is the nomen midrabanan of kiddushin. If a young girl gets married only midrabanan, it's either a case where her father passed away, and now there's nobody to marry off while she's a ktana. So then if her brother or mother marry her off, or she marries herself off, there is kiddushin midrabanan. Those kiddushim derabanan can be annulled through miyun. Or it's a case where her father married her off, and then she was divorced from that marriage, In that instance, she's now a yitoma b'chayei aviha. She's an orphan in the time of her, or lifetime of her father. But if then, if she gets married after that, those kiddushin would only be midrabanan because she's no father no longer has auspices over her. That kiddushin derabanan again can be annulled through miyun. That's only true as long as she is a ktana, as long as she's still a minor. The annulment works just like the kiddushin work midrabanan while she's a minor. If she already comes of age, and in the other gemarot that we've learned, we've seen that they also have to have bi'ah once she comes of age, then to consummate the marriage as gedolim. So in that instance, she'll need full-fledged girushin. She will require a get, but miyon will work until she comes of age. And so now, what the Gemara is saying is, let's lafuki mid Rav Yehuda. Demar achi beshachor ala lavan is the girsa that was in the Gemara. The Rashbam takes it out because he says there's no relevance to the lavan. White hairs have no impact. The only thing that we care about here are black hairs. And the way that Rav Yehuda says it is that it's not enough to have shtei se'arot in order for her to consider to be a gdola for miyun. Rather, it has to be that there is a large amount of black hair that's there, indicating that she's already gdola, and that precludes her from engaging in miyun at that point, because then she's deemed to be a gdola. The truth is that Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, as the Balei Tosafot say over here, it's not clear whether Rabbi Yehuda's position is unique to miyun, or this is general position, that a child is not considered to be a gadol or gdola with two se'arot. They need much more than that. They need an indication of a large amount of black hair in that area in order to be considered gdolim. Is this unique din with miyun? Or is this something across the board that he believes? So we don't know where Rabbi Yehuda's opinion extends to. We know he says it by miyun. We're just uncertain as to whether he says it in other places as well. And so therefore, the Gemara over here says that when Rabbi Nachman and Shmuel say you need to check for Shtei Sarut, they're coming to deny that opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, who says that Yirbe Ashtachor Ala Lavan. Again, the Rashbam takes Ala Lavan out because he says white hairs make no difference. And so what's Ala Lavan? Lavan is not relevant to this case at all. On the other hand, the Balei Tosafot, the Rabbeinu Tam, keeps the Girsa in and interprets Ala Lavan not to refer to the hairs, but rather to the skin. In contrast to the hairs, which are black, the Lavan is the skin that is white. And that's what it means, Shirbe Ashachor ala Lavan, that there'll be more black hairs than skin that is visible for her to be considered a gdola here by miyun. And so what Rav Nachman Mishmor is saying, that's not true. The check is for Shtei Sarot, and that is the threshold by which she becomes a gdola in these cases. And that's what it says here, Kamash Palon, Dolo, Kurab Yehuda, that the stock of the statement of Rav Nachman Mishmor comes to exclude that position of Rav Yehuda. It is impossible that this also goes back to what we saw earlier as to whether when a hair is white versus black or it changes from white to black, does that have any implications in terms of puberty? We saw before that the Rishonim, the Rashbam, and the Balei Tosafot believed that there was no difference between white and black hairs, although the Rabbeinu Tam was of the opinion that there is such a difference between white and black hairs, even though he doesn't explain it over here. But because of that, there are other Rishonim who say that the Girsa should be Shachor ala Lavan, because there is a difference between black hairs and white hairs. But nevertheless, the Rishbam takes it out, and that's why the Girsa in our Gemara does not include that terminology. The fact that he says over here that you have to wait until 20 to engage or transact in familial property, that comes to exclude the opinion that says Ben Shmonesre. The other opinion of Rav Amram Rav Nachman that we saw yesterday, who says that 18 was the threshold and not 20. Now the Gemara comes to a conclusion about a number of things that we've just seen recently. Toksman, kilif nezman. Like we saw yesterday, that when you're within your 18th year or you're in your 20th year, it's considered to be the equivalent of being before that time. I mean that you need to complete a full 20 years or you need to complete a full 18 years. And that's also true in other thresholds that we have in Halacha, whether it's 12, 13. You have to complete that full year in order to get over the threshold. That year itself, the 12th year or the 13th year, is still considered to be kalifnei hazman. Ve'ochata k'gidel bar menashe. Now, look, it's like Gidel bar menashe, who we saw yesterday, who queried of Rava in the case of that 14-year-old girl who knew betiv masal matan, who was savvy and was able to transact, whether her transactions were binding. And what the Gemara here is saying is the halacha is like that question of Gidel bar menashe. The way that the Rishbam learns it, l'shitato, that's referring to familial property, and that's because these people are considered to be super savvy or have the tiv masal matan, therefore their transactions are binding. If they are not savvy, then when they reach the age of 18 or 20, over here again, we're passing 20, and once you reach that age of 20, then that threshold means that no matter what, your transactions are binding as long as you're not a shoteh. You don't have to be some savvy, great buyer and seller. Simply the fact that you're over the age of 20, we assume already that you are good enough or your transactions are going to be binding at that point in time. That's the Rishbam Lashitato. For the Rif and the Rabbeinu Gershom and the others that we saw yesterday that divided between familial property and non-familial property, the halacha being like Gidol Bar Menashe would refer to non-familial property, that you have a right to transact in that from the age of 13 or 12 for a girl until you reach the threshold age of 20, where then you can transact in familial property. Or for those that said it was referring to Metaltalin, then it would be that the halacha is like Gidol Bar Menashe by Metaltalin, but as pointed out yesterday, the Rashbam rejected that view that it was Metaltalin. And over here, the Rashbam makes this comment, which we discussed yesterday, that the Baal Tosafot brought from the Rabbeinu Tam, who disagrees with this, although the Rif does believe it as well, is that we're only speaking about here with regards to the threshold of 20 is Dafka b'nechasei aviv. It's only true with this familial property, avo b'nechasim shenatnu lo b'matana, gifted property, o shekana metaltalin, kana, or if he purchased items, she'enam yushat avotav, that are not coming to him through Yerusha, hanu mocher pachot b'ben esrim kedin metaltalin, that he can do under the age of 20, similar to metaltalin. And therefore, according to the Rashbam, this is unique din with regards to familial property. Although we saw, again, there being a time yesterday, we saw it apply to all properties that the child was involved with. The Hilchata Kimar Zutra, and the Loch is also like Mar Zutra, that qualified the statement yesterday with regards to Edut, that their Edut is a good Edut. He also bifurcated that din between Karka and Metaltalin, and said that by Metaltalin, their testimony is good testimony once they come of age. But for Karko, they have the same threshold age of 20 like they do with regards to transacting in the property. Again, we saw yesterday the machlokes between the Rashbam and Rabbeinu Gershom on one side who believe that it's referring to any testimony with regards to Karko versus Metaltalin. And the Baal Tosafot who think it specifically refers to Shum, the assessments of values with regards to Metaltalin and Karko. And that distinction made by Bar Zutra is the halacha. The Hilchotoke Ameimar. Halacha is also like a Meimar who said that despite the fact that there's a threshold age for transacting in properties, that threshold is not relevant by Matana. And if they gift at ages younger than that, then that also will be considered a gift, unlike transactions that happen below that age range. And then Rav Nachman Rav Shmuel is what we started today's daf with, which is the cases of Bodkim, the Kedushin, the Gerushin, the Chalitza, the Miyonin, plus the fact that 20 is the threshold age. Halacha is like Rav Nachman Rav Shmuel over here in all of those instances. And the next Mishnah begins, Mechalek Nichasav Alpiv, someone who's distributing his property, and here seemingly he is Eish Chimera, Rabbi Elazar Omer, Rabbi Elazar says, now as far as the Girsa is concerned over here, there's some machloket as to whether here the Girsa is Rabbi Elazar or Rabbi Eliezer, which if it is Rabbi Elazar, it'd be the Tana Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua. If it is Rabbi Eliezer, it'd be the Tana Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkunus. The Balei Tosafot here, it's a long Tosafot, go through the proofs of the Rabbeinu Tam to show that the Girsa over here should be Rabbi Elazar and not Rabbi Eliezer. The main proofs that he has is from the fact that the next Mishnah has Rabbi Eliezer in it. So first of all, there might be stirot if we don't say that they're two different individuals, as well as the fact is that the Mishnayot should have been combined into a single Mishnah, which includes the position of Rabbi Eliezer both here and in the next Mishnah, rather than dividing them into separate Mishnayot. The fact that the Mishnayot are separate, the Rabbeinu Tam says indicative of the fact that it must be two different authors of these opinions, or that the Rabbi Elazar that's mentioned here is not the Rabbi Eliezer that is mentioned there. Therefore, we're going to follow that position of the Rabbeinu Tam that suggests that the Girsa here should be Rabbi Elazar, and we're going to use Rabbi Elazar until we reach the next Mishnah, where we will then change to say that the Girsa is Rabbi Eliezer. So here, an individual who is distributing his assets, Rabbi Elazar Omer, Echad Bari, Vechad Misukan, whether he's a healthy individual or whether he's on his deathbed, a Misukan, Nechasim Sheish Lemachrayut, if this is real property, Nikneim Bekesib Bishtar Bechazaka, they require the Kinyanim of real property like the Mishnayot and Kiddushin tell us, that you can use money, a shtar, or demonstrating ownership, taking a Chazaka in the property. All of those are normal Kinyanim or vehicles for acquiring. Vesh Ein Lehen Achrayut, And metalkalin, non-real property, ain't niknin el bimshicha. They require a kinyan mishicha. So in essence, what Rebbe Lazar is saying over here is that everything we've learned until now with regards to a matnat shchemira just isn't true. That matnat shchemira, matnat bari, and even mitzaveh, mishum mita, as we're going to see the Rishonim point out over here, Rebbe Lazar believes that all of those require a kinyan. And there is no such concept or takana derabbanan to allow the individual to pass property simply through amira. The Rashbam over here speculates that because of Rabbi Elazar's position here that requires a kinyan for any passing of property or any transaction whatsoever, that the din that we learned before, that imamat chuzer, if he distributed all of his assets, that then if he survived, we assume that there's an umdan adat, that he only gave them away mishum mita, and therefore they would be reversed if he survived, that Rabbi Elazar would not subscribe to that position as well. Because he believes, basically, there's only one type of matana, and that's a matnat bari. Even if you're a shchiv meira, you're still gifting things like a bari. And if that's the case, then you don't have a right of retraction, even if you survive over here. And that is the opinion of the Rashbam. There are those that disagree and say that you could separate out the issues. He might require a kinyan, but he might also differentiate between a shchiv meira and a bari, and say that when it comes to a shchiv meira, there is an umdan adat that exists, even if you do it through a kinyan. Similar to the way that we believe, even though you don't need a kinyan by shchiv meira that gives away all this property, if you do a kinyan, chain we paskin like Shmuel, which says that it still has that umdan adat, and the kinyan does not make it into a permanent gift. So similar to the way we view that in the position of the chachamim, we could say the same thing here in the position of Rabbi Elazar. That's the view of the Rashba over here, that you can retract such a gift, even according to Rabbi Elazar. Now, there are those Rishonim that say that if the person was gifting these matnot were given to parties that are not yoshim, then that's where Rabbi Elazar says is din. But if these gifts or distributions were given to yoshim, then that comes under the rubric of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, who says that you can distribute in that manner, and therefore he would agree that you're doing it derech pirushtaden and not derech kinyan. The Yad Ramal claims that it would be possible that Rabbi Elazar would agree in that case that you could facilitate such a gift, or really yerusha, without a kinyan. So Amrlo, the Chachamim said back to Rabbi Elazar, Maseh b'iman shel b'nei Rochel. This is a case that we quoted earlier in the Gemara back on Kufnun Aleph, that the mother of the b'nei Rochel, Shaita Chola, she was sick, and from the story it seems like she passed away from the sickness, Bamra, and she said, Tnu kabinati libiti, give my kabinati libiti. Again, we had quoted before the Balei Tosafot that discussed this back on Kufnun Aleph, where the Rashbam and Rashi suggested that the kavinati here is a nushka, which is some sort of necklace or choker, and the Balei Tosafot disagree with that based on the Gemara and Shabbat, and they quote the Aruch that thinks that it is a crown of some sort that was worn on the top of the head. But she wanted to give to her daughter this particular item. It was worth 1,200 zuz. Umeita, and then she passed away. Vikimu et divareha, and the Chachamim kept her word, or they facilitated giving that gift to the daughter, even though there were sons here, and they were the rightful Yorshim. Despite that fact, they upheld what was looked seemingly a matnat shchiv meira. Amar lahen b'nei Rochel tikabrim imam, that their mother should bury them. So what Rabbi Elazar is answering in the end is that we can't bring any proofs from b'nei Rochel because there's something wrong with these b'nei Rochel. We can all discuss what is it that was bothering Rabbi Elazar about the b'nei Rochel. But as the Rabbeinu Gershom explains over here, the Fishayu Rishayim, since they were Rishayim, Tikbrahim Imam, so that's the curse, their mother should bury them. Baimi Vein Rayamehem, you can't bring any proofs from them. Shemutav Shitira Shabbat Yoter Mehem, because it was more appropriate that the daughter should get it than them because of their sins. Or the way that the Rishabam phrases it over here, it was a knas. The Chachamim, in essence, created or instituted a knas over here and gave away the property to the daughter, even though the sons were the rightful heirs to that property, which does bring up other issues about the powers of Beit Din in these situations. Obviously, they have Hefker, Beit Din, Hefker, but should they be interceding, or did they just let it happen and did not enforce the law over here, which would be an easier way to understand it, that they were passive in this situation rather than active. But because of that, Rabbi Elazar says, yes, that's what happened over there, but that's no proof to the fact that you can have a matnat shchiv meira without a kinyan. Now, either over there, you have one of two options how to explain the case. Either she was giving away all of her property to his daughter, and that's why it would be a matnat shchiv meira, and not require a kinyan according to the Chachamim, or it was just a gift of a portion of her property. Now, if it's a gift of a portion of property, we believe that you need a kinyan for that. Even the chachamim believe you need a kinyan for that. So then you would have to say that it's a case of mitzaveh machmat mita, that she was commanding it on her deathbed, where she specifically mentions the fact that it's because of her death that she's gifting this. And there, even a matnat, shchiv meira, that's mitzaveh mishum mita, matana memiksat, is binding, even if there's no kinyan. So you have to explain it in one of those two ways. And Rabbi Lozder rejects it. And from here, that's what the Rishbam concludes, according to the explanation that it was a matnat shchiv meira with all of her assets, then we would know nothing about Rabbi Lozder's opinion by mitzaveh machmat mita, and he might even agree with the chachamim. Or if you say it was a matanah b'miksat, like the Gemara did earlier, then you would have to say that it's a case where he disagrees even by mitzaveh machmat mita, that Rabbi Elazar argues not only about the case of a matnat shchiv meira, but even a case of mitzaveh mishum mita, that also, Rabbi Lozer believes, requires a kinyan, and it's not binding simply by articulation. Tanya, Eva Breita, Amar lehem Rabbi Elazar, the Chachamim. Lozer says, the Chachamim, Maseh b'Maroni echad, sheyah b'Yerushalayim. There was this individual, Maroni, as the Rishbam says, is someone from Maron, that was in Yerushalayim, ve'yolo metal t'lin harbei, and he had a ton of non-real property, b'keish litneim b'matana, and he wanted to gift them to individuals or to his heirs. Amar lo, ein lehem takana, ad shikneh agav karka. The only way for you to distribute these assets is to do it in a kinyan agav. So halach, v'lakach beit zela echad samuch l'Yerushalayim, went ahead and bought property that was not fertile, property that could not be used for planting because it was rocky, and therefore it would be cheap for him to buy the property. So he acquires the property, and then he says, v'amar, tzvono l'ploni, he gifts the northern piece of that property to so-and-so, v'imo me'atzon ameo chaviot, and along with that, he gives 100 of my sheep, he gets 100 of my barrels of wine, and that he was doing as a kinyan agav. Udromo the ploni, and then the southern part of that beit sela will be to so-and-so. V'yemo, and as a kinyan agav, me'atzon, me'achaviyot, then he will give the me'atzon, me'achaviyot, umeit, and then he passed away. So the assumption, the fact that it says here, umeit, it seems to indicate that it was a matnat shchiv meira, because otherwise, why mention the fact that he passed away? V'kimu chachamim et divarav, and the chachamim kept whatever he had instructed. What he had done, they made binding. Amrulo. So the Chachamim said back to him, Misham Raya, why do you bring any proof from there? Maroni Barihaya. You assumed because he died, that meant that when he was gifting it, he must have been a Shchibira, and therefore be a proof to your position that a Matnat Shchibira requires a Kinyan. You got that wrong. He was healthy when he was gifting it, and then he happened to die afterwards. It wasn't that it was a connection between the gifting and the fact that he passed away. So the Godabach notes the fact that the Gemara over here said umeit by this story shows you that mita was a pivotal factor as to why Rabbi Lazar thought the din should be this way. Because if you believe like the Rashbam that there's no difference whether he passed away or not, according to Rabbi Elazar, the gift is binding, then why bother to mention the word umeit over here? There's no relevance to it. If you want to suggest it's because it's a matnat shchiv meira, that's not true, because the Chachamim in the end disagree with that. And their disagreement is that he could have been a bari, and he happened to pass away. It doesn't prove that he was a shchiv meira. So what it must mean is that Rabbi Elazar is showing from the fact umeit that it was a mitzaveh machmat mita, because otherwise mita would not be relevant. And that's why the mita over here is relevant, because only since he died is the gift binding. Had he not died, the gift would not have been binding. And for that reason, he disagrees with the Rashbam on these two points. Number one is that the case here is not a case of matnat shchiv meira, rather a case of mitzaveh machmat mita. He also disagrees with what the Rashbam said on the previous amud, that Rabbi Lozer thinks that even if you survive, that the gift is binding and you can't unwind it. The Bach says that's not true. The fact that the case here says umeit shows you that only because he died was there a gift binding over here. Had he not died, that would not have been the case. And therefore he disagrees with the Rashbam on these two points. One is, first of all, that Rabbi Lazar would agree by mitzaveh machmat mita that you don't require a kinyan. We saw the two possible explanations of the case of the Bnei Rochel and the Mishnah. And according to the explanation that it was a matnat shchiv meira with all of her assets, then we would know nothing about Rabbi Lazar's opinion by mitzaveh machmat mita, and he might even agree with the Chachamim. That's what the Rashbam suggested. Or if you say it was a matana b'miksat, like the Gemara did earlier, then you would have to say that it's a case where he disagrees even by mitzaveh machmat mita. Over here, the Bach says that's just not true. You see from this case that Rabbi Lozer disagrees even in a case of mitzaveh machmat mita. And therefore, he disagrees on both those points with the Rashbam. Number one, that the possibility that Rabbi Lozer would agree by mitzaveh machmat mita is not true, because the case of the Maroni Echad is a case of mitzaveh machmat mita. Number two is he disagrees with them that had he survived, it would still be binding. Says that's not true because the case says that he died. And the relevance of him dying is because that's why it was an effective gift or a enforceable gift, is because he passed away. Had he not passed away, that would not have been the case. And therefore, the Bach and Otei on the previous Amud disagrees with these two conclusions of the Reshbam. So, Amalan b'nei Ruchel tikabrei miman, my time akalait lehu. Why is Rabbi Elazar cursing them? Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel, mikaimei kutsim bikerem hayu. They used to keep thorns in their vineyards. Rabbi Elazar l'tamei, and this is Rabbi Elazar l'shitato, it's not. Hamikayim kutsim bekerem, someone who keeps thorns that are growing in his vineyard, Rabbi Elazar omer kidesh, that causes the kerem to become kilei hakerem, and therefore makes the whole thing asur b'hana. Achamim urmim lo kidesh, that there's no consecration here in the negative sense. It doesn't turn into kilei hakerem. Odavar shekamohu mikayim, because this isn't something that people normally would keep. So now there are two stages to here. One is to know that the din of kilei hakerem is not simply planting grains and vines together, grapes and grains together, but even after they have grown there, unbeknownst to you, they start to grow there, if you allow them to stay after they've grown, then even being mikayim, even keeping intact that status quo will be deemed to be kilei hakerem. And you can even get malkot for that because amikayim kilayim is chayav b'malkot. So therefore, now we come to the situation here where we find thorns in their kerem. The machlok between Rav Elazar and the Chachamim is whether that is deemed to be kilei hakerem. The Chachamim say, listen, nobody cares about thorns. Thorns are the equivalent of weeds in one's vineyard. So you can't suggest that the keeping of the thorns in the vineyard is kilei hakerem. On the other hand, Rabbi Elazar says, no, thorns in the vineyard are classified as kilei hakerem, and we'll see in a second why he has that opinion. Obviously, what the Chachamim say makes sense, because it says, tizrak karmecha, that you plant your kerem. Planting your kerem means planting with something that you want. You don't plant thorns because you don't want thorns. So then, if you don't plant that, then the keeping of those items in the kerem should also not be deemed to be kilei hakerem. But based on that machloket, Rabbi Elazar the Shitato said, since they kept their thorns in their kerem, they kept kilei hakerem. They were engaged in this avera of kilei hakerem. Therefore, he was upset about it. What you see from this also is that when they do something like this with kilei hakerem, you can curse them or affect them in other areas of halacha, like in this issue of the gifting of the property from the mother to the daughter. So now, the Gemara says, Bishlamo karkum chaze. When it comes to saffron that you keep in the vineyard, it makes sense that people would want to keep it because it is an item that people would eat. It's an item that people will use. So therefore, it makes sense to keep it there. Now, why the Gemara here mentions karkom at all seems strange, but if you look in the Masorah Shas, he points out that that was the girsa in the Yerushalmi. That the case here was that they kept karkom in the vineyard. So it's clear here that the Bavli is picking up on that position of the Yerushalmi and disagreeing with that position of the Yerushalmi and saying that if it was karkom, even the Chachamim would agree that it was problematic because that has utility. It's chazi. It's usable. Elukotzim, the mai chazi. When it comes to thorns, why would Rabbi Elazar ever believe that that's a problem of kilei hakerem? What can you use them for? So Rabbi Chanina, my time of Rabbi Elazar, what's the reason behind Rabbi Elazar's position? Came by Arabia, mikaimin kotsim besadot the gmalehem, because in Arabia they actually grow these thorns as feed for their camels. So whatever these thorns are, they're not the standard thorns that we're thinking about. There was obviously a specific species, a breed of thorns that was eaten by the camels, and so therefore in Arabia we see that people do keep it, and it is considered to be a food item. Whereas the Chachamim say, that, as the Rishbam says over here, that we follow the Rubo Shel Olam. The majority of the world does not keep around these kotsim, and therefore the ruling will be Batel de Ta'atam Etzel Kol Adam, that those people in Arabia that keep it, they are the unusual, they are the outsiders or outliers in this situation, and they won't govern how we look at thorns in general. And so the Chachamim believe that it's not considered to be Kilei Hakerem. On the other hand, Rabbi Elazar says that since in Arabia they do this, that shows you that they do have utility, or people do use them, and they're classified as a quote-unquote food item or feed, and therefore they will create kilei hakerem, either because it's enough that one place uses them to say that they are considered to be tizrak karmecha, or you have to say that it's true in Arabia because they have camels there. In places where they don't have camels, they don't keep them, but had they had camels, they would also keep them. And so therefore you don't say b'tela dato etzol kol adam in that instance, because their behavior is not outlandish or outlying behavior. It's simply that they are in a particular environment where it's necessary. Other people don't have that necessity, but had they had that necessity, they would have acted in the same way, and therefore their deeming of these thorns to be feed should affect everyone and not just themselves. That's the machloket between them, and that's what led Rabbi Lazar to say about the Bnei Ruchel, Tikberei Miman, because of their behavior as Rishayim, as we saw before, either the Chachamim established a knas and penalized them and gave the gift to the daughter, even though they weren't supposed to, according to Rabbi Lazar, or according to what we saw in Rabbeinu Gershom, that the fact that they were Rishayim made it that we preferred to carry out the instructions of the mother, even though they may not have been the right way to do it, according to Rabbi Elazar. Amar Rabbi Levi, Konim Kinyan B'Shiv Meira Afilu B'Shabbat. Rabbi Levi says that we do a Kinyan from a Shchiv Meira even on Shabbat. Halo L'Chosh L'Divi Rabbi Elazar. Not to worry about what Rabbi Elazar says. Ela Shemati Tarif Dato Alav. Rather, because we're worried about him losing his mind or becoming uneasy about the fact that he can't gift. So we have here a situation, as the Rashbam claims, it's a situation in which either you might need a Kinyan or you don't need a Kinyan. It could be a Matnat Shchiv Meira B'Kulu. He's giving away everything that doesn't require a kinyan, or a case where he's giving away mikzat and it does require a kinyan. We would have thought the reason that we require you to do a kinyan, or we allow you to do a kinyan on Shabbat, is because the gift will not be viable unless you do a kinyan, and that would be possibly like Rabbi Lazar. So what Rabbi Levi comes along to teach you is that's not the case. The reason we allow you to do these kinyanim on Shabbat has nothing to do with Rabbi Lazar. It's not the fact that it wouldn't be binding without it, but rather it's for leaving the person who's on his deathbed in a state of ease. We don't want him to think that the kinyan's not going through or it's not binding. He might think if he just simply articulates it, it won't be enough. Or he doesn't feel like the gift is really given. And therefore, he wants to make a kinyan to reinforce it. So we allow him, or we even encourage him to make the kinyan in order to feel better about it because of the fact that Shema Titaref Datolav maybe will cause him to be uneasy or in a problematic state because of the fact he thinks that the gift won't go through, he won't be successful at gifting it. And so that's to the exclusion of the position of Rabbi Elazar. This is part of where the controversy comes up as far as the Girsa is concerned, because we're going to see in a second in the next Mishnah that Rabbi Eliezer has a position explicitly with regards to Shabbat. So how do you reconcile that position of Rabbi Eliezer with this Gemara over here that seemingly says that you do Kinyanim on Shabbat against Rabbi Elazar, when Rabbi Eliezer in the next Mishnah says that you are supposed to do Kinyanim b'Shabbat? So therefore, the change in the Girsa to Rabbi Elazar solves that problem. That's what the Balei Tosafot mentioned, because then it makes it easier to read Levi's statement independent of the next Mishnah, which is Rabbi Eliezer. I just know that there are Rishonim who think that it is referencing to the Rabbi Eliezer in the next Mishnah with regards to Shabbat, and then they have to explain why or how that relates to the Gemara that we just stated over here. Now the next Mishnah says, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, B'Shabbat Dvarav Kayamim, B'Pein She'en Yachol Lichtov. A Matnat Shchiv Meira works on Shabbat without a Kinyan because there's no choice. On Shabbat, you can't make Kinyanim, because it looks like Mecca Chumemkar, and therefore the Chachamim put a takana in place that they are kimisurim uchutuvim dami, so that when he orally gives the gifts, that they are successful gifts on Shabbat. Avalo b'chol, on a weekday where there's no necessity for that, because you can do kinyanim on a weekday, therefore we'll demand that you do kinyanim on a weekday. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, b'Shabbat amru, if you say by Shabbat that you can use the matnat shchiv meira through an oral gifting, then kal v'chomer b'chol. And certainly on a weekday, the same would be true. Because, as the Rashbam explains to us over here, that generally we have a principle, called ra'ui l'bila, ein bila me'akevet bo. Something where you could accomplish the kinyan, then that kinyan in general is not the me'akev. So if you're going to say that the Chachamim instituted a takana on Shabbat to allow the Shchiv Meira to gift orally without any kinyan, even though on Shabbat there's no right to make a kinyan because of the problems of Mecca for Memkar, and therefore it's your only alternative, then certainly on a weekday where you do have the alternative to make the kinyan and to transact in that way, certainly the oral gifting should work, which is that on Shabbat, where you can't make kinyan nim, it seems like the kinyan should be ma'akev. Nevertheless, the Chachamim granted him the right to gift orally. And certainly on a weekday where he has the ability to facilitate it through a kinyan, certainly over there, he should have the ability then to gift it orally. That's the logic of Rabbi Yeshua. And Rabbi Eliezer's logic is the opposite, which is that only in places where it was impossible to do a kinyan, there the Chachamim instituted the kana to overcome that problem and to gift it orally so that lo titaref alav dato, so that the person who was passing away would be at ease. But that doesn't mean that on a chol or on a weekday where it's not necessary that they institute it, when it's not necessary, they said, use a kinyan and don't use this oral transmission. So that's the machloket here between Rabbi Lesser and Rabbi Yoshua. In Kiyotzi, but we have a similar machloket between them in terms of Zchiyah, which is that acquiring something on behalf of another party. Where Rabbi Elazar says, the chin katan, bein zachin the gadol, that you can acquire on behalf of a katan, but you cannot acquire on behalf of a gadol. It means that a third party can come in and then take possession of something, which is zachin shadam shalom bifanav. You're able to be zocha on behalf of another party. So Rabbi Eliezer over here says that only works by a katan, because a katan doesn't have the ability to accept the gift himself, because ain lo yad l'skot atzmo. He doesn't have a yad, he doesn't have the capacity to accept on his behalf. Over here, the Rabbeinu Tam says that that must mean that he's under the age of 6 or 7, that he doesn't have a yad to be zocha, that he's so young that he doesn't have a yad, because as the child gets older, then it seems that they do have a yad to accept things, and therefore we must be talking about a very young child. So what the Chachamim did was they facilitated the ability to get items or matanot to this child by third parties being zocha on their behalf, because there's no other option. The child themselves cannot acquire it. Therefore, we use this kinyan of zachin in order to circumvent that problem. But for a gadol, who he himself can be the recipient of the gift, then the Chachamim did not give you the right to have another party acquire on his behalf, or zachin shadam shalom bifanav. That's the position of Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Yeshua Omer, Rabbi Yeshua argues here again and says, if they allowed you to do zchia for a katan, then certainly they will allow you to do zchia for a gadol. Now, either for one of two logics, one of which is the same as before, which is that kol roi lebila in bila makevet bo. So here, the katan who can't make a kinyan, nevertheless, we still say there is a ability to have zachin shelo b'fanav, or someone be zochei on his behalf. Then a gadol who could make a kinyan for himself, certainly someone else should be able to make that kinyan on his behalf and be zochei on his behalf. Or the way that the Balei Tosafot and the Rashbam, this is the shita of the Balei Tosafot in general, that zchia is mishum shlichut. The ability to have zchia comes from ability to appoint a shliach. Or in essence, the person becomes your shliach because anan tzadeh. We see that this person definitely would want this gift or want this benefit. And so therefore, when this third party accepts it on his behalf, it's as if he made him into a shliach and as if he made him into a proxy to accept it on his behalf. Well, katan is not a bar shliach. He can't establish a shliach, and nevertheless, the chachamim allowed it to go through, then certainly a gadol who has the ability to appoint a shliach, certainly he should have the ability to have zechiah or be able to have another party acquire on his behalf. Therefore, it's a kal v'chomer that you should be able to be zachin shalom v'panav when it comes to a gadol. That's why the Mishnah brings the two machlokot together, because it's a similar idea. Did the chachamim only establish a takana where it was necessary? That's what Rabbi Elazar says. Rabbi Yeshua says, well, if they established it there, where the takana shouldn't work, then in places where you have the ability to do other things, real kinyanim, certainly the takana chachamim should help out those individuals as well. So, Nitan Mani, who is the author of a Mishnah? Rabbi Yehuda, it is Rabbi Yehuda. The Tanya, we have a Braita, Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda argue about the machloket between Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Meir Omer, Rabbi Lezer Omer, b'chol, devarav kayamim. Only on a weekday is a matnat shchiv may work orally without any kinyan, mipnei sheyachol lichtov. Because kol haroi lebila, ein bila makevet bo, since he can gift it through a kinyan, then he has a right to do it orally. Avalo b'shabbat. On Shabbat, that is not the case, because since he can't gift it through a regular kinyan, he also does not have the right to gift it orally. Rabbi Shua Omer, Rabbi Shua again says, b'chol amru, b'kav v'chomer l'shabbat. If on a weekday where it's not necessary to institute something from the Chachamim and they allow him to grant it orally without a kinyan, then kav v'chomer l'shabbat, then certainly on Shabbat, he should be able to do it where there's no other alternative. So this is the opposite of the logic which we saw before, and that's why, of course, Rabbi Meir is not the author of our Mishnah, but rather Rabbi Yehuda, because Rabbi Meir has the logic reversed over here, where Rabbi Eliezer is saying it's chol is the way the Chachamim instituted it because there are other mechanisms, kinyan works there, so too does the oral transmission. Shabbat, where the kinyan doesn't work, then the oral transmission doesn't work. Rabbi Eliezer comes along and says, if it works on a weekday where it's not necessary, then on Shabbat where it is necessary, it shouldn't work. Piyotzebo, and similarly with Zechiah. Zechin gadol and Zechin katan. Divi Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer again says that a kinyan Zechiah, or Zechin shalom panav, or Zechin for another, and a person works for a gadol because he can accept it himself, or he can generate shlichut, and therefore someone can do it on his behalf as well. But the katan, who has no ability to acquire on his own or to establish lichut, then it doesn't work at all. You can't have zachin shalom b'fanav in that case. Similarly again here, if you're instituting it to work by a gadol who doesn't need it, then certainly you should institute it by a katan who does need that help. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda has the positions similar to what we have in our Mishnah, and that's why the Gemara just said that the author of our Mishnah must be Rabbi Yehuda, which is Rabbi Lez Omer b'Shabbat v'Rav Kayamim. When it comes to Shabbat, then it works when you have a matnat shchiver orally without a kinyan, because there he can't write, and it's his only alternative. On a weekday, that's not the case, since it's not necessary, they didn't institute it. If it works by Shabbat, where their other kinyanim don't work, then certainly on Chol, where other kinyanim do work, then it's certainly this institution, the Chachamim, should be effective. Similarly, Zachin the Katan, they created Zachia for Katan, the other parties can make acquisitions on behalf of the Katan or accept things to the benefit of the Katan, because he doesn't have any other way to acquire items. But by a gadol who has these other mechanisms, the Chachamim did not give him the right of zchia. That's the position of Rabbi Lezer. Rabbi Shua Meir, the Katan Amru, Kavachom and the gadol. They said that it works by a Katan, where these other Kinyanim don't work, then certainly by a gadol where he has the other vehicles and he can create Shlichut. And so therefore it makes more sense that he should have had this zchia. Then certainly it works by a gadol. And therefore Rabbi Yehuda is the author of our Mishnah. And again, all of these institutions of the Chachamim are to facilitate the ability of the individual to gift on Shabbat or at any time, Shaloti Tarif Dato, so that he feel uneasy, or it doesn't cause him to become even more ill or lose his mind from the fact that he doesn't see his gifting coming through or being successful. Therefore, the Chachamim established these abilities to grant property or to do these things even on Shabbat and even orally. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Kufnun Zayin Amud Aleph.